Yasya.
Yasya.
Whose.
Whose.
Iha.
Iha.
In the universe.
In the universe.
Avaya.
Avaya.
Avayavai.
Avayavai.
By the limbs of the body.
By the limbs of the body.
Lokan.
Lokan.
All the planets.
All the planets.
Kalpayanti.
Kalpayanti.
Imagine.
Manishina,
great philosophers.
Kati
Adibihi, down from the waist. Adha, downwards. Sapta, seven systems. Sapta Urdvam, and seven systems upwards. Jagan,
Jagan Adihi,
front portion.
Front portion.
Translation to text 35. The Lord, Mahavishnu, although lying in the causal ocean, came out of it, and dividing himself as Hiranyagarbha, he entered into each universe and assumed the Virat Rupa, with thousands of legs, arms, mouths, heads, etc. Purport. The expansions of the planetary systems within each and every universe are situated in the different parts of the Virat Rupa, universal form, of the Lord, and they are described as follows. Text 36. Great philosophers imagine that the complete planetary systems in the universe are displays of the different upper and lower limbs of the universal body of the Lord. Purport. The word Kalpayanti, or imagine, is significant. The Virat universal form of the Absolute is an imagination of the speculative philosophers who are unable to adjust to the eternal two-handed form of Lord Shri Krishna. Although the universal form, as imagined by the great philosophers, is one of the features of the Lord, it is more or less imaginary. It is said that the upper seven planetary systems are situated above the waist of the universal form, whereas the lower planetary systems are situated below his waist. The idea impressed herein is that the Supreme Lord is conscious of every part of his body, and nowhere in the creation is there anything beyond his control. So now we're getting into the creation here of the planetary systems, their situation. So here we have this element is that we have the great sages, and these great sages, they meditate upon this universal form because they don't know the personal form. So, and in here we hear that it's imaginary. It's not that it doesn't exist. This is the subtlety of it. It exists, but that would be the only thing that's imaginary. Right? Let us say we know someone. We know someone, then if someone shows us something that belongs to them, we think of the person. Right? We don't think of the thing, we think of the person. Does that make sense? Right? It's just the form comes there. So, but those who do not know the person, they think of the thing. Right? That's the difference. So that thing is the person. That's what's imaginary. The thing exists. But to say that that's the person, that's what the imaginary aspect is. Because all the energies of the Lord together, that's the complete whole, that's the Supreme Lord. So we just take one aspect of that, it is the Lord, because it's non-different. His energies are non-different. But at the same time, there is a difference. Because he's not just that one energy. Right? So we take Indra, or we take Vayu, or Agni. But all those together, and more, that's Krishna. Does this make some sense? So that's the difference, is that those who are Brahman or Paramatma realize they don't actually understand fully the Lord. Right? The one sees the energy, The one sees the person, but not so much the energy, and the Bhagavan realization sees the person and their expansions. Like that. So here's then, the Lord then has, as Mahavishnu, has created the universes, and these universes then sit on the water for some time. Then after that time, then the Lord enters into each universe as the super soul of the universe. That's Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. So he says, dividing himself as Hiranyagarbha, he enters into each universe. So the creation aspect, that's Hiranyagarbha. So he enters. And so then he then sits in the universe, and from him then everything becomes manifested. So by meditating upon him, then it starts one on the path. The best is you just remember the Lord. Right? That's what's recommended by the Lord himself. You just remember him, that's the best. If you can't do that, then you start doing elements that will remind you of him. Right? Does that make sense? So the name, form, qualities, pastimes, that's him. So these are various aspects you can remember, but if even that we are unable to remember, then we try to see him through the material energy that we deal with. Right? It is his potency. We become absorbed in management. But that potency of authority comes from Krishna. Right? We become absorbed in economics. But that concept of prosperity is coming from Krishna. Right? Energy means opulence. So that's therefore where this concept comes from. Lakshmi means it's all opulence. So then we're able to see the Lord there, or the senses themselves. Then we see through the senses, engaging them in the Lord's service of the Lord's senses. Or we see everything through the eye of knowledge. Right? But then that knowledge is coming from Krishna. Krishna is knowledge. Right? Does this make sense? So in other words, there are times as devotees that we remember Krishna as Krishna. Right? Either his name, his form, his qualities, his pastimes, his paraphernalia, his calm, like this. But there are times when we don't. But at those times, we're rendering service. Right? So then we're able to see the Lord through these potencies of the universal form. Right? And we can see that it's Krishna that's allowing this. Krishna's the ability. Krishna's... So the closer we can get it to him, the better. But if not, then these potencies are there. Then one can imagine that, okay, these planetary systems, these are situated below the waist, these are above the waist. The mountains are his backbone. Is this? So you see something, it's nice. Why is the mountain range nice? Because it's the Lord's backbone. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. Why is the ocean nice? Because it's his waist. So everything that we see that's nice, it's because it's actually Krishna. It's one of his potencies. So that makes it nice. Does that make some sense? Right. So this is why this is being explained. Because this is the beginning of the Bhagavatam. And we're trying to elevate ourselves up to the level of being qualified for the 10th canto. So that means we're always absorbed just in Krishna. So then these chapters, and here we find in the second chapter, where the discussion of Sukadeva Goswami begins, so he begins with this creation. Because then we understand how we're situated within it. What is our position? How we can properly situate ourselves, or properly interact with the Lord's creation. Does this make any sense? Right. So, another aspect, because we're saying it's real, it's there, it exists, but the value we place on it, that's imaginary. Right? Gold exists, but we say it's valuable. Right? But you put down a nice gold crown on the floor, and the dog will come along, sniff it, and go away. He didn't find it valuable. Right? But he put down some old subji, We don't think it's valuable. The dog thinks it's very valuable. Right? Does this make sense? So, therefore, the things of the universe then are, we call them that. We say this is a building to live in. But others don't. Right? There was one, some locals who were living out in the desert, and they were very happy there. They'd been living there for thousands of generations. And then the quote-unquote civilized man came along and thought, oh, these poor people living out in the desert. So they built them houses. You know, simple little houses. But those local people found this to be an annoyance, because if you sit outside, then no matter how close or far the other person is, you can see them, you can contact, you can converse with them. But this was a problem, because you had walls. So what they used to do, and they used to always sit on the floor, right? Because you sit in the desert, so they didn't like furniture. So they sit on the floor. And because they wanted to talk to the person in the next room, so they knocked holes in the wall just at sitting level, so they could, you know, from any room see each other and converse. And so they were quite happy. Right? So we would think that these walls, nice, private, this, that. So for us, that's a value. For them, they thought it was an annoyance. You know, I'm not sure if after that they continued building them houses, but whatever, this is what they... So the point is that value is very much the individual. Like we may think, oh, having a car, that's valuable. Someone has a bicycle. Someone doesn't have anything. If someone has a bicycle, that's good. Someone else that has a motorcycle, they wouldn't ride a bicycle. Someone has a car, they wouldn't ride on a motorcycle. Someone has, you know, a fancier car. And like this, it just keeps going. So no matter what it is you have, someone else has something else that they would consider what you have is not a car or is not valuable. Right? Does this make sense? Like that. So that's where the illusory element comes up. It exists. When we say illusion, the Mayavadis say it doesn't even exist. We say it exists, but what we claim it is, that is what's illusion. Right? So it's only known as money or vehicle or this or that, because that's actually what the Shastra says. That's actually what God says. The concepts come from Him. So that's where the concept of, some common concept of reality is. Right? Does that make some sense? So that's the principle. Is because Krishna, in his pastimes, there is a real form to it. Therefore, here in the reflection, we see it in that way. Right? We tend to see it in that way. But because we put our own values on it rather than Krishna's, that's the illusion. That's the difficulty that comes up. Does that make sense? So this is, I mean, why you see, why we'll say it exists, but at the same time we'll say it doesn't exist. It means the material elements are there. They are in different, all kinds of unlimited shapes and forms. And they interact with each other in so many unlimited ways. But we will say that the value one puts on it other than Krishna consciousness, that's illusory. Right? It's not real. Does that make sense? So this is the idea. So Krishna enters it so that it has substance, because the living entity cannot relate to the material energy. It's dead matter. Right? It means anything you have, if it's dead, you don't relate to it. Right? Something that's alive, once it's dead, it's not interesting anymore. Right? Relationship is lost. You can't interact. Is interaction what's important? So Krishna enters into the material energy, otherwise we would not be able to relate to it. It's just dead matter. It has no meaning for us. It just doesn't have any interest. No attraction. So because we want this, then Krishna arranges this. Right? He goes to all this, makes all these arrangements just for us, so we can pretend that we're God. Right? Like that. So then, yeah. So here then, the great philosophers, in the beginning steps of God consciousness, They start to see God in the form of the universe. The aboriginals, they'll also see that, but they don't connect the whole thing. One mountain or one rock is God, the lightning, or a crocodile, right? Some of them feel that all of the crocodiles are the ancestors, and after that die, they all become crocodiles, which most likely they do, like this. Like this, then it goes on. But the philosophers, it says here, the great philosophers, they see according to the Shastra. So they're able to see the whole universe together. Then in that, they can see the form of the Lord as the universal form. But actually, the real form of the Lord is His transcendental two-arm form. So that's what we're trying to get through. So we ourselves do not ignore the universal form, and nor do we put great emphasis upon it. Does that make sense? If you can remember the Lord all the time without it, it's not important. It's just one of the many facets of Krishna's wonderfulness that He's expanded into everything. At the same time, is if there is any lack in our Krishna consciousness where we are distracted by the material energy, and we are absorbed in the material energy, then the universal form comes in handy, in that you have a way to connect that aspect of your distraction to Krishna through the universal form. Does this make sense? So that's the... So the universal form includes also Varnashram. Right? Because that's the mouth, the arms, the belly, the legs of the universal form. Right? Then you have all these other elements of the dead matter that you deal with. Right? So the people fit into these, the animals match, all the different branches of knowledge, all the different elements of the universe. This way we can find some connection for those things that are valuable to us. Then from there, then slowly, slowly become purified until that's replaced with remembrance of Krishna in His two-armed form. Does this make some sense? Is there any questions or comments on this?
Yes. The question, you mentioned about the universal form and connection to the Varnashram. There's actually an explanation to how the Ayurveda subject such as Ayurveda, for example, because it says all the different planets, for example, the moon is controlling the mind, sun controlling sight. Mm-hmm. And then so then they have connection also to the material, the micro
the body.
The body, yeah. And the micro-body, yeah. Or within atom or something.
So it's a question.
Yeah, question.
Okay. Okay, so the question is there any connection between the big universe and the small universe, which is the body? It's the same. Because the same potencies that work, the sun is the eye of the universe, right? The sun and the moon like this. The moon is also the mind, so that's also for us. It's only because of the sun, the fire, that the eyes can see. So there's direct connection. For the yogis, then that is actually the small universe. So the body is more important than the bigger one, because that's what we're dealing with and that's what we can work with. So in there, then they will become conscious of it, see its connection to the greater, and then move through it to basically part by part dismantle one's attachment to it. As we see, Yudhishthira Maharaj, at the end, then he merged the earth element into the fire, fire into water, water into air into ether. The ether goes into the mind, like this. They just fold it back until they get to the Mahatattva. Mahatattva is you're on the Brahman platform, but you think I'm the controller and enjoyer. Then one changes that consciousness to I am the servant for pleasing Krishna, then you're out of the material world. Right? That's the key, is that that's the switch between the two. So many methods, processes are there to fold up the universe, but ultimately to get out of it, you must make this distinction between I'm not the controller and enjoyer, and I am the servant. That's why the Brahman and Paramatma realizations are weak. Because in Brahman you make no distinction. And in Paramatma, then the tendency is to think, I am that. Right? That is me. You look into the heart and then you see yourself. So it's only if it's with the devotional eye, then you see I am servant of that person. Then one crosses out of the material. So the reason all this structure is given, and it's given in all these ways, is actually for the process of yoga. Right? It means we're not interested in moving around the universe and understanding its physical aspect as a map to guide us to drive around. Right? So that's why it's not exactly put together. You'll get a very clear horizontal and a very clear vertical description of the universe. But the points at which they connect, that the Shastra doesn't talk about. Because if you do, then the scientists, they will take that and use that for their own purposes to harass the rest of the universe. Right? Because mechanically they'll get the work done. Right? It's just like you can start fire by mantra, but that takes purity and education and sadhana. Or you can start it with, by another form, right? By a mechanical form. So the same way as one can move through the universe by the metaphysical or through the physical. So the physical isn't fully explained. So sometimes that'll be disturbing to the scientist because it doesn't make sense and they will say it's not exact. So they tend to ignore it. But then by ignoring it, they save everybody else the trouble. Right? Because otherwise, they figure out how to dismantle an atom and then it makes everybody's life miserable. Right? Because then there's a threat of nuclear war. It's simply because they figured out how to partially take apart atoms. Right, so that's why it's not explained. But it's explained completely on how you can fold up the material existence and leave the material world. Right? How to fold the material existence and connect yourself to Krishna. Always remember Krishna, never forget Him. So always remember means remembering Krishna in His two-armed form. His name, form, qualities, pastime. Never forget Him means don't become distracted by material energy and understand how everything you're distracted by is actually Krishna. So the yoga process, the karma, jnana, buddhi, jnana, this is all processes how to use the material energy to elevate yourself. Right? So that's done through the micro, through the body. But if you don't understand an element of the body, you understand an element of the universe. You don't understand an element of the universe, you understand it from the body. So that way you catch it. Does that make sense? So this way you can understand how things work. Everything is connected like that. It means all the sciences deal with the greater or they deal with the smaller. All the sciences deal with the energy and the energetic. Right? So, if you don't understand the energy and energetic in one aspect, then by looking at it from another, you can catch it. It's just like you're describing, let's say, astrology. From that understanding how male, female works, you can actually understand what are the principles functioning in family life. So, if you don't catch it in family life, you can catch it here. If you don't catch the astrology here, you can give the example in family life. Right, so each one, or you don't understand the astrology, you give an example from Ayurveda. Or you don't understand the grammar, you give from logic. You don't understand logic, you give it from grammar. Like this. So that way, so many branches are there because someone's intelligence is naturally developed in a particular area. That's what makes their uniqueness. And that combination is also unique. So then the Shastras are so broad that through any one of them, you can learn the metaphysics of the material world and about Krishna. Because it's all is Krishna, that's its purpose. Right? But because we're not interested in Krishna, we're interested in philosophy, but then when it gets down to, let's say, cooking, we just cook. Or mechanics, we just do that. Or management, we just do that. But if we sit in a class and we contemplate the Shastra, then we become philosophical. We look from that angle. But when we do practical work, the tendency is to forget the philosophy. Therefore, these other branches of knowledge, though they're mundane, they're described they are coming from Krishna and described in such a way that you can then, through your mundane distraction, get back to Krishna. Does that make sense? So then, yes, the whole universal form and the whole that whole thing is designed so that you understand how the body works, so you can transcend the body. Right? Does that make sense? Anything else? Yes. When we get a flower garland from Krishna, yes? How is the reciprocation eternal when the garland fades and the Mahaprasad is digested? In the same way as your relationship is eternal, even though your body is getting old and is going to turn into, you know, dust. You understand? In other words, a contact is man-made, that contact is eternal, the medium is not important. The medium is secondary. The difficulty when we come to the material world, we put too much emphasis on the field. But the field is where we interact. The field is not the interaction. Understand? You have man A, man B standing outside the front of the temple. Right? But for the interaction means because they're in front of the temple, you take the field into consideration how they're going to interact. Let us say they are best friends, but they may not be as intimate or wild as they might be if they were in a room somewhere. Right? So the field will be considered, but the field is not actually it's the medium for the interaction. Right? You give a gift to somebody, it's not the gift that's important. The gift is a way of showing one's affection. Right? And you're giving that gift based on the person, so you consider the field. But it's because it's something you think they will appreciate or can use. That's why it's bought. The thing itself doesn't matter, right? If they were, needing more plates and cups, then by getting that for them, it would be appreciated. Right? But if they already have, you know, 257 tea sets they've been given by every relative and acquaintance in the universe, then the, you know, 258th, though they will smile and say thank you, it will not be of value to them. Right? So then it will be, they're trying. So the idea is the exactness in the field is to match the exactness in their actual relationship. You know what I'm saying? The expression of the relationship. Therefore, since we're dealing on this temporary platform, its temporariness is also illusory. You know what I'm saying? We take the material energy so seriously that its temporariness we also take as important. When it's not. You know? The temporariness of the material world isn't so important. Right? It's important in that it wakes us up, that we should understand that the situation we're in that we say is valuable is not going to last long, so why do we take it as so valuable? Right? That's going to go. But the element of... Because the material energy is always there. The material elements are always there. Sometimes they're manifest, sometimes they're not manifest. Right? But it always exists. And these different forms, those forms are always there because they're in the blueprint of the material creation. Sometimes they're manifest, sometimes not. Universal form is there. Right? So sometimes universal form is manifest, sometimes not. But that form that's not manifest is still Hiranyagarbha. It's still Mahavishnu. Right? Mahavishnu is expanded from Shankarshan. It's expanded from Krishna. Right? So all the form and shape that you see here is simply the reflection of the other. So, does that make sense? So it's not important that it disappears. The important thing is that the relationship has been established. That interaction is there. So that interaction will not disappear. Like that. But the situation in which that interaction is there, that's always changing. Right? Even in the Lord's Leela, it's always changing. Right? Radharani cooks something, it's great, she never cooks it again. Right? So, therefore, because it's already been experienced, so you cook something different, so that can be experienced. Right? Does that make sense? How much free will does a person have, and does it change according to varna and ashram? Free will is always there at every second, and not to disappoint you, no, free will is not enhanced or detracted by any of the ashrams. It's just a matter of what you want to be tied down by. That's all. So that's your free will. You want to be chastised by and disappointing the spiritual master and in this way develop the good qualities to go back to Godhead, or do you want to be done by relatives? You know? That's all. You want to work in the city, then your boss there, you would say, I'm going out to the forest. Still, it will do the same thing to you. It rains, it gets hot, you fall into holes, animals chase you. You have to know that you're not the controller. Whatever situation you're in, because it's the same, the material energy has been created to remind the living entity of his eternal relationship with God. And to develop those qualities necessary to interact with God on that platform. So the same lessons are learned. It's just a matter of how entangled within the material energy you want to get to learn the same lesson. That's all. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, let's say you're doing an equation. A math equation, and you're shown how to do it. Ideally, in one or two exercises, you've understood it. But if not, you keep doing exercises till you do understand it. So whether you do two or three, or whether you do 100, the point is you get to the same place. Does that make sense? So this idea that there is freedom in any of them, this may appear to be contradictory. But there's freedom in any of the, more or less in any of the particular ashrams is not there. Like that. Does that make sense? That's not. It depends how you define freedom. If freedom means doing what you want to do, then there's no difference. Because you're going to do what the material energy has given you to do based on your previous activities. Does that make sense? Right? So here's a simple definition of free will and predestiny. You know, the eternal confounding question of many devotees who things aren't going the way they want. Right? If things are going great, no one asks this question. Right? People are respecting you, all the facilities are there, it goes the way you want. I've never heard one person ask, what about predestiny? Don't we have free will? No, everybody enjoys the good ride. The ride gets bumpy, then immediately, well, hey, I don't want this bumpy ride, so where's my free will? Right? So, free will, okay, let's say they're connected. Free will is what you do to your free will, choose to do with the situation you're in at this moment. Predestiny is the result of that free will. Right? In other words, the free will is your desire and your endeavor. The predestiny is the situation that you find yourself in. You understand? There's two different things. That's why it's, unless you can separate the field from the activities of the field, you'll have difficulty. Right? Does that make sense? Means you are sitting in this place, in this class now. This is the situation you're in because of your previous free will. Previously you decided, okay, I'm going to Bhagavatam class. So because of that decision, now you're in this situation. Now what you do here, that's your free will. You pay attention, you don't, you fall asleep, you talk to your friend, you get up and leave. That's what you do. But depending upon that, that will create future situations for you. Does that make sense? So the two are connected. You can't separate them. So at every moment, you're subject to predestiny. And at every moment, you have the free will of what you're going to do in that position. Right? You may say that, no, I'm not, I don't have the free will, because that's only because of your set of values, what you do with the situation. So therefore you see, oh, there's only one thing to do here. So it's forced. No, but you could take the opposite. You could take a different... You know what I'm saying? But because of your own particular value system, therefore, you will say, well, this is the only way to do it. Which is fine, because that's the free will. But it appears that way because you restrict yourself by your own values. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. So that's that. Is that okay? Okay, last question. You have one. So the question is, we're living on this planet, are there living entities on other planets? If they can know Krishna, can they know from other planets Krishna? Yes, because that's who they're working for. Right? The upper planets, they're all working for Krishna. Right? Indra is working for Krishna. Vayu, Varuna, Brahma. So they all know he's there. But the tendency is because their facilities are nice, they forget about Krishna. On the lower planetary systems, they're not really interested in Krishna, but they know he exists, like that. But they're not interested. So that's why this planet is perfect, because it's not so nice that people forget, become so bewildered. At the same time, it's not so bad that they become so absorbed in the external. Does that make sense? Right? Like that. Okay. So we'll end here, and then if anyone likes, we'll continue with questions. Grantaraj Shiman Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jaya Jai Go, Premanand. Hey, Udi. The assembly of the Vaishnavas and the study of the Shastras. Okay? Always remember. That's yours. Come on. Okay, any further questions or anything else someone has? Yes, Bob, yes.
Is it important for a student to...
Is it important that the student... If the student reveals the mind to the teacher, is it important? It is important, but it depends upon that degree of trust, to that degree how much is revealed. So it's natural with the development of the relationship, then to that degree, then the mind is revealed. Like that. You know, so, but still, revelation can be that you said if I should do this, and I did it, and it worked. You know, so that's nice. That's good. Does that make sense? So, like that. So it's, yeah, that element is there. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it gets personal. It can be just practical. In other words, they're giving you, because at the same time, as they're generally not going to give you, they're only going to give you more intimate or more developed instruction as the relationship develops also. You know what I'm saying? Because the principle is one should not give knowledge to someone who's not going to value it. Right? That's why in the general open forum, then it's kept general. It's valuable for everybody. But it doesn't necessarily become too specific or too intimate, because otherwise, if it doesn't match the individual, they either can't use it or won't appreciate it or will misuse it or will misunderstand it. So that's why generally the teacher is very careful to only express things on the level that the student can understand. Sometimes due to the nature of the preaching mission, we sometimes may go beyond that boundary. But it's not without risk like that. And generally that risk is being not valued or misunderstood or misapplied, like that. So that's why the principle is only reveal how much is actually be able to be understood and used. Even though one's enthusiastic, the potential is there, it's not done. Because if it is done, it will only be wasted, like that. You know? So that's the principle. So generally the instruction that one's got, based on that, one can reveal one's mind. You know what I'm saying? So that's the principle. Is that okay? Yes.
Why did you decide when you went to the spiritual world, this kind of sinful, that Krishna
is your question, how can the living entity have sinful desire in the spiritual world? Okay, what kind of desire is it that gets one into the material world? Yeah? Okay. So, basically, what kind of desire gets you into the material world? Envy is the main thing, but this arises due to indifference. So it's actually due to a lack of desire you get yourself in the material world, technically. It's the envy that puts you here, but it's envy can only arise if there's lack of desire, lack of interest. So, in other words, Krishna is there. We have the opportunity to... We are tathasta, right? Tathasta means marginal. That means it has the potential to develop love for Krishna, but hasn't. That's tathasta. Now, this tathasta then can either come under the influence of the internal potency, develop love for Krishna, and enter into the shelter of the internal potency, or it can, by association with the external potency, develop an interest there, right? But in the tathasta point, there is no interaction, there is no that's basically just existence. You know what I'm saying? So, because the living entity is active by nature, that's not actually an option. We have to be active. So that will either put us in transcendence or ignorance. Does that make sense? Right? Because we're getting to the answer. So, now, if we do not develop any, take any interest in Krishna, we maintain that tathasta position, that indifference, then we, in being active, have to be active in some way, so we will become active within the material concept. Then from that, we will want to be the controller and enjoyer. Does that make sense? So that puts us here. So, you fall from the tathasta position. You don't actually fall from the transcendental position, because you're actually not in it. You're transcendental in that you're not situated in the material world. But here, actual transcendence means situated in the internal potency. Right? Because if you're not, then that situation is not stable. Right? Does that make sense? You can be in an unmanifest state in the tathasta potency, but once you manifest, you have to be active. And so therefore you have to either take shelter of the internal potency or the external. Right? Does that make sense? Why doesn't he keep us as a demigod forever? The demigods have to follow too many rules, you know. So they're restricted. Right? Nala Kuvera and Mani Griva ended up as trees because they wanted to be drunk and be naked with women in water. Right? So sex in water is illegal. Being naked out where others can see you is illegal. Right? Not trying to change your conjugal mood to one of formality when a senior person walks into the area is illegal. Right? But now take a dog, he doesn't have to follow any of that. So that's why the living entity, even though Krishna would be happy to that you don't leave the spiritual world, the living entity, even though he's put as Lord Brahma, then he comes down as Prajapatis and his great sages and that, and then like this keeps going down until he gets right to the bottom, because that's what he wants. Does that make sense? Yes. Is it always true? Oh, okay. Is it true that the statement that I say the world, India is the best in India, then Bengal, and in Bengal, then Nadia, right? Just as a side point, a side example, have you ever seen the local people when they become political and they want to make some political statement? What do? Yeah, here in this district. Yes, and what are they doing? Yeah. So, these are complete materialists who are simply interested in politics, and still the method they use is sankirtan. You understand? That's why this place is the best. if you can catch someone here, Prabhupada gives the example like the Westerners, means who have taken up Krishna consciousness. We're very far from Krishna, but we're facing Krishna, so that's good. And if you keep facing Krishna, you get closer and closer. Well, he said in India, they're very close to Krishna, but unfortunately they have their back to Krishna. Right? So now if you can get one of them to turn around, they're already there. They eat meat, but what meat do they eat? They eat cows? No. I mean, just saying, you're talking about those who have a little interest in the Indian culture. Muslims eat cows because Hindus don't. That's why they eat cows. Because it says that the Quran says, rather than give trouble to a lot of little living entities, you know, just catch one big one. So over there in their parts, a big one means a camel. Right? They're not supposed to be over here. You know what I'm saying? It's supposed to be they're eating camels, not cows. Right? So better one camel than, you know, 20 sheep, because then it gives disturbance to one living entity. You know, so that's there. But here it's because the Hindus don't eat cows and they have to eat cows. You know, it's just like Hindus put the top of the leaf plate, you know, the rib on the top, Muslims put it on the bottom. No, they put it upside down. That the Chinese side we use, they use the other. So it's everything's backwards just because the one does it this way, they do it that way. And sometimes it's the opposite, because the one does it that way, the Hindus do it this way. So it's just establishing their unique religious identity. But what I'm saying is those who claim to be, then they don't eat. And that's because Shastra. So you see, much of what they do is according to Shastra. Right? The relationship with the family, their duty towards the family, everything is all Shastric. They understand basically they're not the body, and they understand higher principles and God conscious, but they don't really, they're mixed up. It's kitchery. So if you can get that focused, then you have someone who can really do something. He knows how to deal with people. He has a family. They're happy. They do what he does. Right? Have you ever noticed that? I mean, maybe now it's harder to see, but when I came to India, then the teenagers did what their parents did. There was no generation gap. There was no such, this concept of adolescence is a new thing. Just because people don't know how to deal with the children, therefore, then it becomes very obvious when they hit adolescence. You know what I'm saying? But if you keep going, then it'll be when they are young kids. That will be, you know, and then it'll be when they're a baby. You know what I'm saying? It's just if you don't know, it just doesn't work. Whatever stage. So they didn't have these kind of problems really. You know, because they know personal relationships, therefore the family does what they do. And they have the same values. So now if you make that person Krishna conscious and give them that preaching, that missionary spirit, he can go out and whoever he deals with, he can deal with them as a human and make them interested in the cult, philosophy, culture, and practices of Krishna consciousness. Well, we can go out and very successfully, it's hardly anywhere except for a person that's not interested in philosophy. But generally anywhere we go, we can make anyone interested in philosophy. But you'll find a majority of those people are not interested in our lifestyle or culture. Why? Because we don't have one. You understand? We don't know how to live with ourselves, let alone with others. Therefore, no one else is interested in it. Well, they're in the same boat. Great. You guys have taught us philosophy. You answer a million questions. Great. But when it comes to being practical, then they turn to someone else. You know what I'm saying? Because they see a consistency between the Buddhists and their lifestyle. Right? Or someone else and their lifestyle. But they don't see between us. Some follow it, many don't. Because we'll say, this is the philosophy, and then we'll say, and this is being practical. And the two don't match in any way, shape, or form. You know? You know what I'm saying? So people are smart. They're looking for answers. People who are interested in philosophy are smart enough to understand that it doesn't hit the ground. Therefore, when they see people in robes, that saffron, they don't think Hare Krishna, they think Buddhist. Well, if you go back 20, 30 years, what we said was what we lived, a little wild, a little unsophisticated, but, you know, shaved head, robes meant Hare Krishna. You know, Buddhist was something you've heard the name, but you wouldn't know what one looked like. You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, it's very important, actually, that cultural form. So that's why this place is unique. Because if you can catch the culture that a Bengali, high-class Bengali follows, you can relate to anyone on the planet. And Prabhupada is the perfect example. That's the thing. Because there is, on the mundane platform, there is no one more sophisticated and subtle and sensitive than a high-class, trained Bengali gentleman. There's nothing better than that. Like that. Other parts of India, they become very sophisticated, they become very high-grade, very cultured, but the sensitivity that's there is not there. You find it only in Bengalis. Anyone can learn it, but I'm just saying it's not inherently there. And if it is there, it's very rare. You know, other parts of India, other communities, you'll find that person. But it's not common. But if you get into that realm of Bengali gentlemen, they're all like that. Well, gentlemen somewhere else, some are sophisticated, some are not. They're nice people, pious. You know, will do anything for it, but they're not. They don't have that sense. So, with that sensitivity, then you can catch and preach to anybody. As you see, Prabhupada, he could talk to heads of state. He could talk to women journalists. He could talk to you know, dirty hippies. You know, he could talk to professionals. You know, like the Dainapan Wallas. No matter where he went, he got through. They appreciated him. Everybody said, someone was telling me, I think it was that when they were working on this project for Satsrup Maharaj, for the Leelamrita, the one common thing they noticed about every non-devotee that they interviewed was they all mentioned that Prabhupada was a gentleman. So one thing they said in common. Other than that, they had different ideas. Like that. So that's why it's special. It's because of what's there. Of course, it can get covered and disappear, you know, just like that. But this is Lord Chaitanya's place, so if we, you know, play our cards right, we shouldn't be the ones to make it disappear. You know, it should be after 10,000 years, then it disappears. You know, like that. But otherwise, we see it can, because that's been given now. Because of the Purana Gaudiya. In the Vedic, then actually the central place is basically kind of like North Pakistan. Yeah, down into Punjab. It's actually like Punjab and farther up that way. That is Brahmavarta, where the Saraswat Brahmins are from the Saraswat River. So that's actually the center of the Vedic culture. Like that. Then from there it expands down to basically Hastinapur. And that. Then bigger than that it extends down to like Allahabad, you know, UP. And that's called, I think, Aryabhata is bigger. Each one has a name, I can't remember them. Then the biggest is from the Bay of Bengal over to the Indian Ocean, from the Vindhya Mountains, that means from Madhya Pradesh, up to the Himalayas. That swath there, that's considered Aryabhata. That's where the Aryans live. And outside of that, tribals. South, yeah, South is also tribal. Dravidians, they don't consider themselves Aryans. That's why you have these sometimes these big political uprisings, because they want the Aryans to leave. The Aryans meaning the Brahmins. The Brahmins were brought in by Agastya Muni. And so, like that, Agastya brought, Parasaram brought. Agastya seems to have brought from north. Parasaram brought from Bengal. That's why you see the Keralites and the Bengalis are basically the same kind of people, same mentality. Just here they know Lord Chaitanya, there they don't. Because they've been separated for, you know, some millions of years, so. Like that, but they're the same kind of stock. Very matriarchal, very sensitive, like this kind of thing. Yeah. Mother is more prominent. There they've made it into, it's actually legally matriarchal. Well, here it's not, but the mother is important. Yeah, I'm saying is here they worship mother in the form of the devas and all that. There it's the hereditary goes down to the mother. Probably because if you can figure out how to work with women, you can figure out how to work with anybody. Like that. So it's the same stuff. Like that. It's basically that simple. So, because Krishna figures out what energy is, so therefore he can work with everybody. You know, because that's what we're dealing with, is energy. If you can understand that, then socially, philosophically, mechanically, anything you can make function. Because everything functions on the same principle. Like that. There's nothing different there. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Just as a, how do you say? I don't know what you call it. Well, I've given one term, it's called the caveat, but I think there's another thing that's called, you know, where you give a definition of something so that you don't get into any problem. Here, when we say we don't have any culture, the Indians do, that's a very generic one, meaning that we don't necessarily take it very seriously, and therefore we don't practice it as fully as we could to get great results. Some do, some don't. What we're saying is a generic, and that we're saying generically Indians, because much of them are cultured, a lot of them aren't. So we're talking about the cultured ones. And here, in contrast, if those are following, they're getting the same result. But if they're not, then Westerners or anyone will run into the same problem by not following it. So, if a Westerner is following it, he'll get the same result as an Indian following it. An Indian not following it will get the same problems as a Westerner not following it. Like that. So, we're speaking very generally here. Hopefully no one will take this out of context. Yes. We never return yet. So what's the question? Why won't we come back?
No, that means we never started out there.
Once going there, you never return. Doesn't mean you didn't come from there. See, the problem is that dealing with this question of where do we come from, we always like to fit it into time and space, which is mundane. So the mundane cannot understand the spiritual. So that's the problem. Because you're not mundane, so how can you have come from here? Right? You're tatasta. It's a different energy. Right? You are tatasta yesterday, you are today, you will be tomorrow. And so when you go back to Godhead, you're still tatasta shakti. But you're in the fire of the internal potency. You don't become internal potency. That's why the example of absolute is given as iron and fire. Right? Krishna is absolute. He's not iron and fire. Right? You understand? The fire is the internal potency. The iron is us. That's why the definition is given. Otherwise, we'll have a tendency to fall back on other non-Vedic definitions of of absolute. That means non-Vedic means if there's any flaw whatsoever anywhere, then it never was and never can be. Right? It never was, and it's eternally damned. So, great preaching platform. Like that. And, you know what I'm saying? So, that's why these non-Vedic, generally religions aren't spreading so well. And because it doesn't work for them, it won't work for us if we take it up either. Therefore, iron and fire means unlimitedly you can pull the iron out of the fire, and unlimitedly, this is the important point, you can stick it back in the fire. Because according to some modern doctrines, once it's been taken out, it cannot be put back in. But if you ask even the unintelligent, uneducated blacksmith, he will say it can be. So it's unfortunate that such educated persons are less intelligent than even a blacksmith. Right? A common Shudra knows more than these highly intellectual, educated people, because he knows you can put iron back in fire. So that means that any time the soul, which is meant to be in the fire of internal potency, can be put back into it. Does that make sense? So the concept of eternal damnation doesn't exist. It's a mundane concept developed by mundane people who are unable to convince others of the value system they have, so the only way to try to get some effect of influencing others is through fear. That's all. So that means that preaching system is dead. And it also applies even to any authority. Parents also, that's only based on fear. That parental relationship is actually dead. It's not living. That child will not develop the values of that parent.
What you're saying is, this thing,
it means that once you actually understand what's going on, then when you go into the fire, you won't go back. You know what I'm saying? Is we keep going out because we don't think it's wrong. It's just like sticking your hand in the fire. You're using the opposite. It means you don't know what fire is, so you put your finger in it, and you get burnt. But once you know what fire is, you won't put your finger again. So once you actually get out of the material world, you won't come back because you know what it is. Right? From that aspect. That's the negative. But from the positive, you only actually get out because you connect yourself to Krishna. And once you've tasted the higher taste, there's no interest in the lower taste. Does that make sense? That's why time and space is not overly valuable. It's used occasionally, but it's not actually a prominence in self-realization. Because we're not dealing with time and space. If you become Krishna conscious now, sitting right where you are, seemingly on the material platform, you're in the spiritual world. And the person next to you in mundane consciousness is sitting in the material world. So that's why the Bhagavatam and the other literatures describe the universe and the methods the way they do. Because there is no time and space, factually, on the spiritual platform. At any moment, you can surrender and become completely Krishna conscious wherever you are, using anything. Right? Pingala became self-realized, sitting out on the corner trying to catch a man for business. But through that, then she saw, this doesn't work, no man is ever, so therefore, that's because the mundane man and the mundane female has never been satisfied by this mundane maleness. So, but satisfaction is there, so the only real satisfaction is God. He's the real male, and we are actually his female. So in that relation, we can have eternal satisfaction. And in this way, in that God-realized state, she happily then took her rest. You understand? You know, what's his name? What's his name? As a demon, became self-realized. You know, fighting with Indra. What's his name? Yeah, Vritrasura. Yeah, Vritrasura. Right, doing the duties of a demon, fighting the demigods, and he's pleasing God because he's God conscious. He's the one preaching to Indra, you have no faith. God gave you that weapon, the thunderbolt, to kill me. And you don't have faith in it. You're relying upon your club, which you used before, and it didn't work. Therefore, you went to Vishnu and asked him what to do. He gave you the thunderbolt, but you still have no faith. So if you're actually a demigod who's asura, who surrenders to God when things go wrong, then pick up that and fight. Right? And he's being instructed this, the king of the universe, by a demon, how to be God conscious. Right? So that's the ultimate point, is that anything within the universe can be used to be God conscious. That's why anything in your day-to-day life, you can connect to Krishna. You know? The little things that are important to you, you can connect to Krishna. Does that make sense? Yeah. So don't try to apply time and space to this question of where we came from, because it'll never be understood. Because sitting right where you are, you can be in the spiritual world or in the material. So that's where the whole, that's where two parties come up fighting over this issue. It's because it's based on time and space. If you don't add time and space into the equation, then there is no argument. Does that make sense? About the
culture,
yes, please. If you're a Gaudiya Vaishnava, do you have to follow Bengali culture? That would be like saying, you know, if you are a Homo sapien, do you have to be classified as human? I think you missed what we're saying. Gaudiya, that is the Bengali culture. The Bengali culture is the derivative from the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. Right? Where do you get the culture from? Right? Means the North Indian culture comes from where? But what's over there next to Rajasthan? Dwarka, that's the next question. That's where do we get South Indian culture from? So you understood from what I just said? Oh, you heard that from someone else. Okay, we'll get to that in a second. We're just finishing this and we'll get back. So, Braj, from there you get your North Indian culture. From Dwarka you get your South Indian culture. Right? From Sweta Dweep, which is where Lord Chaitanya performs his pastimes, which is where the Bengali culture comes out of. Does that make some sense? So, the point is the Gaudiya culture is the culture by which you can get into Braj. Right? That's why, as Gaudiyas, we don't deal with the Dwarka culture, the Vaikuntha culture. Right? It's just the same culture, there's just slight flavors that make the difference. Right? It's the same Krishna, but in Dwarka there's one flavor, in Navadvipa there's another flavor, in Vrindavan there's another. Right? Does that make sense? So the point is it's you get into Braj through Navadvipa. So that's why the principles of it must be followed. Right? That's the thing, is that let's bring up another point, is that someone after Mahatma Gandhi had gone to London and all that and, you know, discussed over there and then come back to India. Then someone said, what do you think of Western culture? And Mahatma Gandhi replied, that would be a good idea. So when you say there's different cultures around, then you're surmising that anything other than Vedic is actually culture. Part of India. Means they will, but you'll see is there is a difference. Some elements are there, it's local, that's not a problem. That's also why it's said that even if one's a devotee, one should marry one's own community. One shouldn't marry outside one's community. You know? Because the inherent value system is the same. And that's what you don't want to be arguing over. Right? So that's why even there it's recommended you kind of stick to your own. Okay, you grow up in the wrong culture, but are there any similarities between the two? Okay, maybe you'll like to eat fat chapatis and dal. Right? You know what I'm saying? Because that's what's available, that's what you eat. But is your worship of Lord Chaitanya and the sensitivity between the Vaishnavas going to be any different? Because the Vaishnava culture is basically the same. Yeah, I'm saying in that way it's the same. But if some slight with the local regional, it doesn't matter. If you're in South and you cook idlis and sambar for breakfast, that's not a problem. You know what I'm saying? Okay. You have a whole range, but you're going to choose which matches with your philosophy. It's all going to connect, yes. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So it's going to connect. Bengali culture is sensitive. North Indian culture is sensitive to the conjugal relationship. It's prominent. Therefore, women cover their heads. South Indian conjugal doesn't really play any part at all in the whole culture. It's there, families are there, but the conjugal doesn't come out in any way, shape, or form. You ask somebody from a good South Indian family, they've never seen their father or mother touch each other. You know, other than maybe, you know, through a door or something like that. You know what I'm saying? Wife's going, oh, you go first, that's all. You know what I'm saying? Therefore, they don't have to bother covering the head, because the concept of conjugal energy being projected just doesn't exist in their culture. I mean, it's non-existent. Right? It's just the way it is. Because they're on reverence and that. Even Lakshmi is not a big deal. You serve through her, but that she has a conjugal relationship with the Lord isn't really important. She's who you serve through. But in North, you know, Sita, that's a conjugal relationship. Vishnu Priya, Lakshmi Priya, that's a conjugal relationship. Therefore, then, conjugal energy is there, therefore the women cover up. You understand? So it's easy. So it means, therefore it applies everywhere. Does that make sense? You know? So the basic principle is you have that, because the Vedic culture means what is connected to Krishna. That's Vedic. So we have our tradition, but it doesn't mean that other elements of the Vedic tradition can't be used if they're favorable. When you're in Bengal, Prabhupada said rice is perfect. It matches the climate, this, that. There's actually no need for chapatis. You don't really have an interest in them. But if you leave Bengal and go to another part of India, like in North, then chapatis somehow or another become very prominent and very interesting. Right? You tend to eat less rice and more wheat. Does that make sense? It's just the way the climate is. So if that's what's available, that's the climate, there's no big problem. So those adjustments just happen this way it is. I remember once I was here, and I forget, there's some stomach problem that I was super sensitive to chili. It means if I in any way contacted a chili for 5 minutes, I couldn't eat. It would just burn and this and that. somehow or another, during that time, we went to Udupi, and we had to do some research work there. We were there for weeks. The only thing to eat around there is stuff with chili, and they take their chilies extremely seriously. You know? But somehow or another, I didn't feel any inconvenience. At all. And I thought, well, maybe the problem's over. Then we had to, something came up, we had to move to Madras for doing work over there. And then again, it was exactly the same. If I just even looked at a chili, like, I'd have problems. You know, saying so sometimes, according to local climate, certain things just work. You know, it's just like, give a very good example. Have you ever, in Rajasthan, seen a fat marwari? These big, fat marwaris. Have you ever seen one? Think about it. Never. Right? But that, because the diet that they eat fits perfectly there, but the marwari eats the same diet here and gets fat. I always wondered that. Why is it that? So I asked the marwari once, and that's what they told me. You know? So it's the climate and the place and what matches the place. It's not, you know, a particular thing. Because all they eat is grains and ghee and butter, and I mean tons, because they don't have vegetables in that. And, you know, seemingly they should get fat, but they don't. Does that make some sense? So there is minor adjustments, but the principles are never adjusted. You never, a principle means you never have to adjust it. Otherwise it's not a principle. Or it may be a sub-principle. There may be something bigger and it's there, but it has some, but it, you know, and then some detail. Because everything has like that. Does that make sense? I mean, Prabhupada took the culture from here, took it to New York with a bunch of wild hippies over there. And New Yorkers are very, very... they take anything and rip it apart. If they're convinced, they do it. If they don't convince them, they don't do it. And they look for faults. But they're open to finding an answer. You know what I'm saying? So you probably wouldn't get more critical people on the planet than those that live on Manhattan. Right? But at the same time, they're open-minded that if you do have something better, they're willing to take it. Right? So Prabhupada went there with the culture from here and established it there with no problem. Right? And they're the ones that could be saying, this is America, this is that, this is so many things, and like that, and they took it. And it worked. Does that make sense? It just depends upon what it is and the culture that's there. There may be some details of ritual that are unique to that area and, you know, that may be criticized somewhere else. But you just have to see is what is the principle behind that written detail and stick to that. So if it's favorable, the detail as it is fine. If it's not, then you find the principle and then use the other detail that's more appropriate. Does that make sense? Like that. Because the principle is the same. You know, if they eat the sweet first and over here they eat the salty first, that's a minor thing. You know? Like that. Say again? When the husband's not there, you cover the head. When he's dead, you cover the head. Okay. Is that important, or means what? Yeah, because it means they're widows. Because then it's not, because the point is the pure feminine energy in its pure form is prosperous. So by covering, you're controlling the energy. You're hiding the energy. So because the energy in its natural form in the South Indian culture is pure, therefore, hiding it is not prosperous. Does that make sense? But showing it doesn't mean it's being shown off like, you know, sweets in the shop in the window. It just means that it's there, but the very pure form of it comes through. But once you cross up into north, then that changes. The women are women, and the conjugal element is there, it's prominent. You know what I'm saying? So therefore, you have to control it a little bit. Otherwise it's too much, so then it's put. Does that make some sense? It's subtle. You get into more. It's just like, if you really think about it, what you can do with a sari is exactly the same thing you'd be doing with your hair if it was open. Right? So the point is women deal with their hair and all that to be attractive. But it creates passion and ignorance if the hair is open and they fiddle with it. So the Vedic thing is that that attractiveness of the woman is there, but through a subtle form that is cloth. So it has the same femininity, but it doesn't have the sensual attraction. Understand? So in South, they don't use that aspect of femininity like that. So therefore, it's not a question. It is if you have that, but I would say is that would only be alive if you were living in South and South Indians. Once you come up here with everybody else, then I haven't seen it. I've seen some, but they cover their head anyway. Because the point is if it doesn't matter if you cover or not, what's the problem with covering? But around here, nobody thinks like that. Like that. You know, has ever you walked out of your house recently and one of the local Mayapur residents went, "Oh, what happened to your husband?" Anyone said? No, so then don't worry about it. But if you're in South with the South Indians, you don't cover, don't worry about it. It's white also. Yeah, so that would make a distinction. Also, he's making that the South, you were wearing some variety of lightly colored. Because the full color means is the woman's confident, so that means there's a man behind her. So she wears full bright colors, like that. Like that. So that light means it's not, just like we wear, it's like this very white with a few designs in it and all that. Technically, it's widow's cloth in some of that. It means for Bengal, widow's cloth means pure white, no borders. But in other parts of India, white with some border and some little booties and all that, that's considered widow's dress. But for us, it's not. So it's, we wear it. You know, so these are details that, you know, according to time, place, and circumstance, and you wear. You know, in other words, you're living here in this community, you wear how we wear. But let's say I had a god sister named Varanasi, and she married a boy from Varanasi. Amazingly enough. And she moved there and was just part of that family. So then naturally she would dress and all those things like the people from Varanasi would. You know, because otherwise it's strange. You know, but in this community then, you know, it's, you know, a half-cooked kichuri, so you don't have to worry about those kind of details. Okay. But if you're wearing white and you're covering your head, then that you might be careful of, yes. So does that mean if you wear white but don't cover your head, it's okay? It's okay. Okay.
It's considered like
common wear. Yeah, you are light, plain, like that. Okay, so pure white, covering your head, don't do that. Your question was about, okay, that we're living in the spiritual world and we simply have to wake up because we're dreaming this and we are interacting in this dream, and when we wake up, then we'll be back in our original position performing our original services in the spiritual world. Basically. But there's a little bit in between. Means we're here, but it's through the illusion that this is real that we're taking part in it. We value it, therefore we do it. Right? It's just like, let us say, you bring a bunch of little candies, and you have a bunch of kids, and you put a big pile of them on the floor, the kids dive on it. Right? You take the same candies, put it on the table, the adults may not even look at it. Right? So it's just a matter of what you buy into. Does that make sense? The point is when you realize that you're not this, but you belong to that, right? Then you will be situated back into your original position and be able to perform in that your original service, right? Your natural service. But the beauty of bhakti yoga, any other yoga, it's this or that, and that's it. Bhakti yoga, while you're still entangled in this, if you identify as servant of Krishna, you are acting technically within your constitutional position as servant of Krishna, though you're still enacting it through this material body. But it becomes spiritualized, and everything you deal with is spiritualized. So when that becomes complete, then you're dealing with the spiritual body with spiritual things. Does that make sense? But in between, then you still get the benefit. That's what's unique about bhakti that no other yoga has. The other yogas, when it's complete, you have it. You're not completed, you don't have it. You do a big karmakanda yajna, 99.9%, you don't have it. You've done the whole yajna, you haven't given the dakshin to the priest, you don't have it. You can't say, I did the whole yajna. Yes, you did the whole thing. Because you didn't give the dakshin, you have nothing. Zero. But as soon as you give the dakshin, 100%. So, but bhakti is whatever little bit you've done, you have that much. That's why it's the superior yoga system. So even you're here, your body is spiritualized and you're acting as if you were in the spiritual platform. And you are in contact with the spiritual potency. Right? But the only thing that separates us is our mentality, our consciousness. So we purify the consciousness, then we are fully there. It doesn't mean that we won't be here still and there in meditation. But with time, then here dissolves, and there we're only there in meditation. Then we're there just in our form. Okay? Yeah. Yes, yes.
In preaching to congregation of the devotees, should we impress upon them the practicality of Krishna consciousness or the culture?
The practicality of Krishna consciousness or the culture? I would say that that's the same kind of question as he had, in that it's meaning the same difficulty as, is there a difference? Practice and culture are the same. In other words, you have philosophy, its application is culture. So culture is practical. But you still have to know what you're doing. Just like, let us say, you take a science, let's say language, and you're trying to get a point across. Depending on who your audience is and how much you have and what the particular topic is, you might use different genres of writing. No? So if you use the wrong one, let's say you use something for a storybook and you're presenting, your medical dissertation. It might not be appreciated. The same way vice versa. You use all this scientific language and you're trying to explain to the kid, just some little simple thing, it won't work. So in the same way, as there is a need for education and all that, no matter what it is. But the difficulty is, due to false ego, we want to feel I'm okay. And as the older we get, the less we want to do learn something new. Right? So that's not can still not be a problem if we don't see any problem in others following the tradition, and we'll just stick to following the principle. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. Let's say, okay, I wear shoes around my house, but I don't wear those shoes in the bathroom. That way my house remains clean. So I like shoes, I'm comfortable wearing shoes around, I wear them. And I have another set of shoes I wear in the bathroom. You understand? So we're getting the principle, though the detail is a little different. Does that make sense? So it's not traditional, but it still works. Right?